This evening, by the grace of God, allow me to say something that may be regarded as a continuation of our previous talk. That talk concerned several people who were lepers in body. Tonight, by the grace of the Lord, I shall speak about a man who had leprosy in his soul. The authority to heal leprosy, and we might add, to pass judgment concerning it, still belonged to the clergy. He was called Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. The gospel presents us with three descriptions of this man. His position was that of chief tax collector. His name was Zacchaeus, and he was also rich. The name Zacchaeus means pure. Being a chief tax collector meant having a very profitable occupation, and a rich man, as you understand, is someone who can provide himself with every comfort. When a man has a good name, an important position, and a bulging wallet, whom does he need? That is how people think. And that is what they pursue, even if they must trample over dead bodies, even if they burden their conscience, provided they rise, succeed, gain recognition, and secure comfortable circumstances in which they can move about freely and enjoy this passing world. Yet this man felt a certain restlessness. If people had humility, they would all admit to feeling it, because this is a truth that must always be spoken. Neither reputation, nor position, nor money can bring happiness. Is that happiness? There are people from prominent families who have important positions and a great deal of money, yet they are unhappy. Rockefeller's daughter was once asked how comfortable she felt surrounded by so much wealth. She smiled and replied, "Do you not know that happiness is not found in money? And yet today people will even sell their souls to make money." People seek to make money, thinking that by earning and acquiring wealth, they will also acquire happiness. That is a mistake. The most unhappy people are the rich. If that is, you draw near to wealthy families that do not live as Christians. We must make that distinction. You will say, "I am better off in my little hut," as the late Father Jerome used to say. Father Jerome, may we have his blessing, was once invited to the home of a shipping magnate in Saichiko to perform the blessing of water when the house was newly built. He performed the ajiasmos and went through the whole house, sprinkling it upstairs, downstairs, in the basement, on the upper floors, and everywhere else. At the end, they offered him coffee and a suite, and the lady asked what he thought of the house. "Geronta, do you like the house?" he replied. "My little cell is better, my child, but man is false and selfish, and he refuses to admit that material things do not create happiness. For anyone who thinks that money, material possessions, and comforts can make him happy is a fool, and even if he prospers, he will hear the words, 'You fool!'" That is the answer the rich fool heard. "Fool, this very night they are demanding your soul from you." Notice it does not say, "I demand it." They demand it. The ones with the horns and the tail. "Come on, get ready. What are you fretting about?" And the man had already lost his sleep when his fields gave him a huge harvest. You remember? How could he sleep? "What am I going to do?" he says. "Well, what has happened to you? Look, there is so much produce, and you do not thank God for it. I have nowhere to put it all, you tell me." And he kept losing sleep over it until he came up with this: "I will pull down my barns and build bigger ones. But is that really a solution? Just try getting tangled up with builders and renovations and see what happens. Then he will lose his sleep completely. He'll become a nervous wreck." And so this man, although he possessed all three parts of the threefold ideal that people desire and boast of today, a respected name, a high position, and money, nevertheless sought to see who Jesus was. And Jesus, what was Jesus of Nazareth? What was he? Some great scholar? Some nuclear scientist? What was the Lord? Nothing. The Pharisees didn't even want to have the discussion. "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Does anything good," they say, "come out of that town? And how wealthy was he? A pair of turtle doves. That was the whole of our Panagia's portion in this world. What name did he have? What did he have?" Nothing. Nothing. And did the elder Joseph, who was thought to be his father, possess anything? What did he have to show? Did he promise anything? Did he pay anyone anything? No. He had recruited about 12 barefoot fishermen, taken them from the shores of the Sea of Tiberias, and went about with them. Naturally, people would have called him a deceiver, a charlatan, or whatever else, a man who misled the people. And yet this man wanted to see him. The soul, then, cannot be satisfied with gold. The soul is not satisfied with gold coins or plots of land, nor with color televisions or limousines. The soul is not satisfied, it remains empty, it remains empty. But our egotism will not let us admit this, and that is why we suffer. That is why there are suicides. That is why there is depression. That is why people lose their minds and the world has become filled with madness. It is because Jesus is absent. In any case, this man faced two obstacles in his effort to see Jesus up close. He encountered two obstacles, one permanent and one acquired. The permanent one was that he was short and could not see because of the crowd, for he was small in stature. Yet he took action so that he might see Jesus. His height, together with the people surrounding Jesus, made it difficult for Zacchaeus to see Jesus and draw near to him. At the first difficulty, however, we give up. We turn back. Many times we get as far as the place of holy confession and then leave because many women are waiting to go in, along with 1,001 other things that we regard as obstacles. That is what we do. And we do not persevere. We do not overcome these things or pass beyond them. For a person must do what water does if he wants to reach his destination. Look at water. Channel it into a furrow. It flows along and finds a stone lying in its path. What does it do? It stays there and fills the hollow. Then it passes around one side of the stone or the other. Or, as we say, it climbs over the stone and passes beyond it, through patient endurance. It does not turn back, and if it retreats a little, it does so only to gather momentum and pass over. Farther on, it finds another hollow. It remains there and fills it. Once it has filled it, it moves forward. In the same way, a person must never give up. He may face difficulty for a time, but he will stand firm, arm himself, regain his strength, and continue his struggle until he encounters Christ. There are many obstacles on the way to Christ. The first obstacle is the flesh, the second obstacle is the world, and the third obstacle is Satan. These are the three principal obstacles a person must confront and overcome in order to reach Christ. If a man is unwilling to overcome his flesh through fasting and prayer, his flesh will prevent him from encountering Christ in this world. If he does not also rise above the world, he will again find it difficult to encounter Christ. And if he listens to Satan, then he certainly will not encounter him at all. And woe to the man who does not encounter Christ in this world, when he enters the world to come. Whether he wishes it or not, one day he will encounter Christ, but there he will encounter him only as judge. The aim is not to meet him as judge, but to meet him here as merciful, to ask forgiveness and set things right here in his church. At what is called the beautiful gate, let us enter into communion with him through Holy Communion for the forgiveness of sins and eternal life. And here, from his instrument, the priest, let us receive our ticket for the world to come. Let us continue, then. Zacchaeus wanted to see who this was, who had everyone in such a stir in those days. From one direction he heard, "Today he opened the eyes of a blind man." From another, "He raised a man from the dead," and there was yet another miracle along the road. Farther on he heard that he had made an eye with a little spittle and a little earth. From elsewhere he heard that he had cast out demons, and from another place that he had healed leprosy. "Who is this man? Let me meet him. Let me see him." Zacchaeus felt an emptiness within. Someone might have said, "Forget what people are saying. What need do I have of him?" But the soul finds no rest in such things. It finds no rest in all that we supposedly offer it. You have many good things laid up for many years. Only the one who created her, the soul, can give her rest. So the man set out to go. But he ran into a crowd. And he is short, he cannot see Christ. Our Lord was surrounded by a great crowd. There were the people he had helped, and they kept coming to be near him. There were people who went out of curiosity to hear what he was saying and to see what he was doing. Others went to catch him in his words, so that they might accuse him before the scribes and Pharisees. Still others needed him, because they were sick or had sick loved ones, so you can understand how great a crowd surrounded him, and consequently there was no easy way to meet him. And here the gospel says, "And he ran ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was going to pass that way. He did not stop. He saw which way the Lord was going. He is taking this main road. I cannot see him in the midst of this crowd. What shall I do?" So he turned down a narrow lane, ran ahead, came out farther along the road, and climbed a sycamore tree. So Zacchaeus climbed a sycamore tree, having reckoned that Christ would pass that way. From above he would have the opportunity to see who he was and what sort of man he might be. That alone was enough for him to see him at least. Who is this man? Is he a man or more than a man? Does he speak like everyone else? What does he do? Does he have eyes, ears, and a nose? What is he like? Who is this extraordinary person? He wanted to see him, even if only out of curiosity. I ask you, if it had been us, would we have made such an effort? Would we have thought of this device, devised this plan, and acted in this way? Someone may say, "I would have done it." Really, would you? Would the mayor have done it? Would the tax collector, the lawyer, the doctor, the architect? No, he would not. How could he? Can a prominent man go running through an alley and then climb up a mulberry tree? Is he a little child, climbing up to look for birds' nests? What is he doing? The next morning the newspapers of Jericho would have written all about it. They would say, "The tax collector has lost his mind. The man has a screw loose. He did this and that. He has gone mad." They already regarded Christ as mad. And now the tax collector had caught the same madness. Is it easy for a man to throw his fine hat down on the ground? Is it easy for him to risk tearing his fine coat and silk shirt up there? Is it easy for him to climb? Was he a 10-year-old child to be a chief tax collector? He must have been at least 40, 45, or 50 years old. Is it easy for a grown man to climb a mulberry tree? No, it is not. And yet he disregarded everything, what people would say, what the papers and newspapers would write the next day, and all the rest. He paid no attention to any of it, so long as he attained what he desired. The world, then, is an obstacle, my beloved, and a man must find a wise way to rise above it. And so forth. Then we must understand that this man is lost, truly lost. He puts it down and leaves it alone. He shuts the world out, but he cannot shut out his own flesh. He has to keep it with him. It is with him when he sleeps, when he eats, when he goes to the bathroom, when he goes to church, and when he takes a walk. He cannot disown his flesh, and the flesh is a beast that is always working insidiously against the human soul. Whatever lawless thing the flesh desires is opposed to the human soul. Wherever a person might give in to the desires, the promptings, the appetites of the flesh, instead he speaks to it like this: "Sit down. I am the rider, not you. You are the carriage. I will take you where I want to go. You will not take me where you want to go." And if a man does not succeed in overcoming his flesh, woe to him, the world comes second, but it too is an equally great beast. The feast of Saint Anthony happened to fall on a Wednesday, and yet, because of the world's opinion, people named Anthony broke the fast and ate meat. How can you celebrate the ascetic, St. Anthony the Great, commemorate his feast, and at the same time place lamb on your table? Even if it had been the occupation, with people starving, you still shouldn't have done it. Eat it on Tuesday, eat it on Monday, eat it on Sunday, eat it on Thursday, eat it on Saturday. But on Wednesday you shouldn't have eaten it. Not on the day we keep the saint's memory. But for the sake of what people would say, people, they served a rich dessert made with milk and eggs, the kind that breaks the fast, and they ate it, that fast-breaking sweet. Why? Because of the world, so that they would not call us Christians, they call us religious fanatics. But why am I a religious fanatic if I fast on Wednesday and Friday, those 2 days of mourning by which I show that I am a Christian? For on Wednesday Christ was betrayed and sold for my sake, and on Friday he was crucified. Therefore, it is a day of mourning for me. Does that make me a religious fanatic? Am I a Jesuit? Why has the woman become like a man today? Because of the world, she is afraid of the world. Would a father or mother ever have bought a child trousers that were worn out and torn? Now they pay more for them than for a new pair. New clothing now costs less than worn-out clothing. You know that? Who imposes this? Who introduces this madness? Who has driven the world mad? The world itself, people imitating one another. How has it come about that today you cannot tell whether a child is a boy or a girl? Who brought this about? The world. It is fashionable. Someone told me the other day that it is fashionable to keep your scarf on when you enter someone's home. But everyone takes off their scarves and hangs them up. No, he tells me, it is the fashion. Do you understand? He doesn't go to church, and many people don't go to church because they are afraid of the world, afraid of being misunderstood by the world, by what people will say. Young people from Christian families don't go to church because of their dignity, because of keeping up appearances. The world, what a kind and gentle beast the world is. How then can a person expect to make any progress when he has made no effort at all to say no to this world? And why should the world conform? Why must I conform to the world instead of the world conforming to me? You know, Charlie Chaplin wore his hat backward, and they asked him, "Why do you wear it backward?" "The whole world wears it the other way," he replied. "Why should I go along with the world? What is this world that sweeps you along? Some empty-headed fellow puts a little horn up here on his head, and straight away you put one on too. What sort of thing is that? Have you no dignity? Are you not a person in your own right? How can you let yourself be led and dragged along behind some corrupt person who has come from the ends of the earth and does not even know whether he is male or female or what he is? How can you let yourself be led along after him, singing his songs, dancing his dances, and making a monkey of yourself? How can such things be fitting? Where is your dignity? Where is your Greek heritage, your manliness? Where have all these things gone? And yet our Christ told us, the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. That is exactly how it is, and even so we do not treat the world as our enemy. The world is an enemy of the soul, and it makes it hard for a person to go. The world wants a party tonight, the world wants dancing tonight, the world wants a night of revelry. And then it makes it difficult for a person to go to church in the morning. I'm not even speaking about the great feasts. Just go out into the streets on a Sunday morning and see the people returning from the various haunts of Satan. These are the people who consider themselves important, boasting, "We went here, we went there," and so forth. They pull a person away from God. These people cannot get themselves up even at 10:30 or 1 o'clock. They cannot go to Christ. They find Christ too demanding. And the world also makes it hard for a mother to be a mother, so that she becomes her husband's concubine instead. Today the world forbids children to be born, and so the mother ceases to be a mother. She becomes a murderess. She is cold, and the result is that she walks with the devil and his angels. My dear friends, the world issues attestations. The world gives out certificates, and we need them. What will the world say? You see, we live in the world, but tell me, where is this certificate from the world accepted? Let the whole world give its glowing testimony about you and me. Go ahead, take that certificate, the one that says you spoke the finest words about me or about you. What is it good for? Only for the bathroom, nowhere else. Forgive me for putting it that way, but it is good for nothing else, and even so a person still hasn't grasped what the world is like. If he makes something of himself, the world will call him a crook. It will call him, I don't know what it will call him, and if he doesn't, it will call him a loafer. That is the world. The people who sin with him, eat with him, feast with him, and enjoy themselves with him often will not even go to his grave. They simply send a wreath by car and do not even attend the burial. That is the world. When Christ told us that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one, and when he said, "Beware of men," rather than "Beware of wild beasts," I do not think he made a mistake. A Christian is different from the world even though he lives in the world. The Christian is a different kind of person. He breaks free from the world, escapes its hold, and answers back to it. But because he is a thorn in the world's side, the world attacks him. I often say this, it is one of my sayings, yet because we cannot bear to have such things said about us, we fall into line with the world. Either you come along with me, or I will make your life miserable. You will have no girlfriend, you will have no boyfriend, you will not be able to go out. Does this not happen now among women as well? Yes, that is the fashion. Women too now have boyfriends. Men supposedly claim a girlfriend as their right, but they do all this to win the world's approval. We'll starve if we shut them down. We'll starve if we close them. That's the extent of our understanding. And that's how much we understand of what this lesson about Zacchaeus has to say to us. The lesson of Zacchaeus is a great one. But he paid no attention to what people thought, or to whether he would shock anyone. He simply got on with what he had to do, so that he could see Christ. Nothing else mattered to him, and in a certain sense he succeeded. He paid no attention to his fine clothes, his position, his ego, or anything else. I must see him. He made this, so to speak, the one fixed desire within him. And you know when a person sets his mind on something, persists, and truly wills it, he is invincible. Invincible, a man or woman in love will not be hindered by mountains, ravines, seas, or oceans. Nothing can stand in the way. Do not let him set his mind on it. Do not let him set his mind on it. If a person truly wills something, but we do not will it. We do not want Christ, nor do we want to know him. Because he exposes our lawless way of life and does not approve the madness of the flesh or of the world. If he were to tell us, well done, my boy, for becoming a girl, and well done, my girl, for becoming a boy, and well done, my lady, for casting everything aside, and well done, that is the Christ we want. But Christ did not do that, nor will he ever do it. So let us bear in mind that this is how he acted. And that we too must deal with the world in a similar way. Yes, I am sorry that today is Wednesday, but come another day and we will prepare a lovely meal for you. I am sorry that I cannot entertain you as generously as I would have liked. There are 1,000 things one can say, 1,000 gracious ways to say them, and you also remind the person who tells you, I do not fast. You do not fast at home. You do not fast here. I will not serve it to you. Some people make this demand, we do not fast. You are the ones who fast. You do well to fast. In your own home you do not fast, but here you will fast. If you wish to eat, what I give you will be fasting food. And if you wish to sit at my table, the meal will observe the fast. That is, if you wish to stay. I'm not going to be the one to defend that, because God says it plainly through Sirach in chapter 15. He has not commanded anyone to be ungodly, but he did not prevent anyone from sinning. Yet you are helping that person to sin. He will remember it all these years. I went to Mrs. Katina's house, and she did this and that for me. And on that day, Christ will use it as evidence, Mr. Nikos's, Mr. Antonis's, and so on. He will use it as evidence on that day. And the result, and when he came to the place, Zacchaeus had gone ahead and climbed up, and when Jesus came to the place, at the head of all these people, he looked up. He lifted his head and looked up and saw him, saw Zacchaeus, and said to him, Zacchaeus, he calls him by his own name, make haste and come down quickly, for today I must stay at your house. Pay attention to the details. Zacchaeus would have been content merely to see him from a distance. Who is this man who works these extraordinary miracles, draws the crowds around him, and has everyone speaking about him? He is not merely a man, the son of Mary. He is also the Son of God. And as the Son of God, he knows Zacchaeus' name. He knows his desire and the longing of his heart. He stops. And while Zacchaeus is settling for less, he would be satisfied just to see him from a distance, the Lord. Though Zacchaeus asked him for one thing, gives him 1,000. So I will give you the chance not simply to see me from far away. not merely to speak with me, but for me to sit at your table and shake your hand, to greet your wife and bless any children you may have, to sit together at the same table, eat the same food, and drink from the same pitcher. You understand, don't you? A person asks for one thing, and Christ gives him 1,000. Many of you will have experienced this, often with humility. We ask him for very little. As people commonly say, if only I could have some little place, somewhere close to God. And when a person says this with true humility, not with a show of humble words, believing that he deserves nothing more, God will give him a place of great honor. That is exactly what he did in the case of Zacchaeus. Can you understand what a thunderbolt struck Zacchaeus? And what a thunderbolt struck all those others gathered around Jesus? Suddenly they raised their eyes, though they had simply been walking along the road. Why would they look up into the sycamore tree? Why would they expect to find a man there? Zacchaeus, of course, must have intended to satisfy his curiosity secretly, hidden among the leaves, and evidently to remain unseen. That is how I imagine and discuss it psychologically and in human terms, and I will take this opportunity to tell you that this sycamore tree survives to this day. Recently it lost the last of its sap and dried up, and they have now placed a covering over it. They have covered it from above with nylon sheeting, and in some places with corrugated metal, so that it will not get wet, and so that as far as possible the trunk that once held Zacchaeus, the tax collector of Jericho, may be preserved for as long as possible. In fact, I have taken slides of it and shown them to you last year, I think if I remember correctly. Well then, think of the shock he received. The Lord himself knew his name and had seen him hidden there. And now the crowd could see him too. How many pairs of eyes below were fixed on Zacchaeus? You know how a fox goes beneath a hen house and stares at the hens, transfixed by the fox's gaze, they fall down, and it eats them. We too find it hard to endure the eyes of others upon us. Many of us even lower our eyes or wear dark glasses. When someone wears glasses, he can look at another person more comfortably. Without them, the other person's gaze troubles him. If you have never noticed this, pay attention to it now that I have mentioned it. Can you understand Zacchaeus's state of soul as he stood up there? He must have felt as though he could die when our Christ exposed him in this way. And what happened? The text tells us of Zacchaeus. He made haste and came down. But how did he come down? Did someone bring him a ladder? Obviously, he must have thrown his arms around the sycamore tree. He slid down the trunk, and there he was, on the ground. And now he picks up his jacket. He picks up his coat. I don't know what season it was. He picks up his felt hat. And they were torn, of course, because he certainly wasn't dressed for climbing trees. Would the chief tax collector have worn even a pair of coarse haircloth trousers? Or some ordinary shirt, for that matter? No, he was a man accustomed to luxury. He wore silks and the like. How could the chief tax collector, with all his money dishonestly gained at that, without toil, have come through all this unscathed? He disregarded all of that, came down, and welcomed him with joy. Then he took Christ into his home. You understand? The Lord left that whole crowd and went off with a thief. When the others saw this, they were scandalized, because the scribes and the Pharisees regarded the tax collectors and chief tax collectors as already condemned to hell. They had already issued them tickets to hell, so when they saw it, they all began to grumble, saying, "He has gone in to lodge with a man who is a sinner." That is how they treated them. But our Christ had told them that the doctor does not go to the person who is well, he goes to the person who is sick. So why does this upset you? If this man is a sinner, as you say, then doesn't he need my presence all the more? And if you accept me as a wonder worker, as a teacher, as then what is there left for you to say? But we human beings imagine that God joins good together with good. No. Often what is good seeks to assimilate what is evil. Christ came into the world for sinners, and Zacchaeus was living in sin at that very moment, so Christ did exactly right by going to him. He left all those respectable gentlemen behind. The door opened, and the two of them entered, Zacchaeus and Jesus. The others remained outside, speaking against Jesus. After a little while, the door opened again. Zacchaeus comes out to the door and says this, And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, Behold, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor. I have 1,500,000 of it I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded, robbed, or wronged anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. Suppose I ought to have taken 100 drachmas from someone, but as a dishonest chief tax collector I took 200. Now I repay him 800 times what I took. Do you understand? In a single encounter with our Christ, this gentleman was left, as the saying goes, penniless and poor. He became poor through one encounter with Christ, who has such courage to give back what he has stolen and restore what he has gained through injustice. Who has the courage to become poor in order to save his soul? Which of us truly believes such things? Instead, we look for other ways, using every kind of lie, scheme, and dishonesty. And we have secured our property, our livelihood, and our pension. Just think of it, on things that belong to others, to the state, to someone else, to some company, or to another person. Yet in a single encounter, Zacchaeus became poor. But his name endured. And if I remember correctly, Zacchaeus later became a hierarch. He entered the clergy. He was saved and became a great man. From a thief, he became a man of God when he encountered Christ. Now someone may ask, how did it happen? How did the Lord win Zacchaeus over, as we say? How did he do it? What could he have said to him? How did he turn him around and bring about such a thing? For this was no easy matter. When the door opened and they went inside, there entered a beast of this world, a lion of this world, together with the Lamb of God. And when the door opened again, the lion appeared as a sheep, offering wool, milk, meat, everything it had. The evangelist does not tell us how this change took place. Someone may ask, why does he not tell us what Christ said to him or how he conquered him? Why should he tell us it was not necessary? The transformation of a human being is a mystery. Even the person himself does not know what caused him to change. He remembers that he used to love this or that. Now he not only doesn't love it, he actually hates it, but how it happened, he has no idea. I remember a man who has died by now, and he used to say to me he played cards constantly, one hand finished, and straight on to the next. When I saw him, I laughed and was frightened at the same time. What's going on here? I said to him. Have I walked into a gambling club? What is all this? Ah, he says to me, Dimitri, we're taking these with us to the grave. Everything you see here, we're taking it with us to the grave, and our game of consina along with it. Of course, if you stay in the mindset you're in now, you will take them to the grave. But if you change your mindset and come around to what I've told you many times, you'll come to loathe these things. Impossible, he says to me. Nature, there's nothing that overcomes it. The one who made nature overcomes it. I tell him, I won't tell you his name because you know him very well. The one who created nature can conquer it, I told him. Of course, as long as a man remains at the mercy of his nature, that is how things will be. But in the end, this man changed his life, repented, and went to holy confession. Gone were the pipes, the hookahs, the smoking pipes, the playing cards. Everything was gone, and he died as a monk. Yes, Christ changes a person's very nature. How he does it, I do not know. Once someone was preaching about the miracle at Cana of Galilee, where Christ turned the water into wine. After the sermon, two men came out and were discussing it on the road. And the one was saying to him, I don't believe that, Mr. Spiros, that the water became wine. Nearby there was a man who mended shoes. And the shoeshine man, who had overheard what they were discussing, says to him, What are you saying, sir? Is this something that really happened? This is something Christian, and it interests me, he says to him. Come here, what did you say? He says to him. That Christ didn't turn the water into wine? He says, Yes, for me, he says. Christ turned the wine into chairs and tables. So the man laughed. Yes, he says to him, that's exactly what I'm telling you. As long as I gambled and drank, we did not even have a chair. At home I sat on an overturned tin can. But from the time I repented, went to holy confession, and changed my life, I had money left over because I gave up wine. And we got chairs and we got tables for the house. Yes, he tells him. Christ did all that for me. Do you hear that? He says. That is who Christ is. He changes a person's very nature. Something you loved yesterday, today you hate. And something you hated yesterday, something you mocked as worthless, you love today. But you must bring this new occupant into your midst. You must place Christ at the center, for this is a mystery. What is it that changes a person? Here was a man who couldn't fast from meat. He'd go and eat it even on a Friday. He couldn't manage on fish or eggs or milk. He had to have meat, and now he eats his food cooked without oil, without a drop of oil. Who is it who brings all this about? That other one, the master of the house. In this matter, the person himself is not the cause. A human being is like a violin. What matters is the violinist. Who is holding that violin? If I take a violin and play it, even the mice will run away. But if another violinist takes the very same instrument, his music will lift you up to the heavens. But it isn't the violin's fault, it's the violinist's. That's what it comes down to. The tenant, who do you have living inside you? If you have Christ, everything is different. If you have the devil, everything is different. That's the reason. So it really is a mystery. What is it that changes a person? What is it that overcomes the world? It overcomes the flesh. It overcomes the ego. It overcomes self-interest. It is a mystery. Simply allow Christ to come within you. That is your task and your proper concern. But a person does not do this, and that is precisely why he does not obtain the results he ought to have. Our church says something beautiful. I don't know if you remember it, or if you've ever worked out what it means, even though you've surely heard it many times. In one place it says, every soul is given life by the Holy Spirit, and is lifted up through purification, and is made radiant, in a sacred and hidden way, by the triadic monad, the Trinity that is one. A mother has clothes made for her daughter or her son, and she tells the seamstress, leave 2 or 3 finger widths of extra cloth folded underneath, because the child will grow taller. By next year it will no longer fit. And the child grows. And the next year she lets the hem down, and it works perfectly. But when did the child grow? Did you ever hear her creak? Do you ever hear, oh, little Katie grew 2 centimeters today? Did you hear a thing even though you yourself are growing? You grow in age and in knowledge. Yet you do not know how it happens. It is a mystery. So it is with the transformation of a human being. The question is not how the one who made you will change you. The question is how you will surrender yourself to the one who made you, so that he can take you up, and he can change you. And all of this in the space of just one encounter, perhaps in less than a minute. It was inside the house that this change happened. So you too bring Christ into your house. And you will see how the master of the house will change, and how everything will change. But you keep Christ outside. You tell him, stay outside, Christ, I do not want you. You will tell me what I may put in my cooking pot, what I may do in my bed, and what I may do with my money. That is precisely why you will remain as you are, or perhaps become even worse. That is the difference. And then something happened which many people find strange. After all this had taken place, Christ in turn said the following. Zacchaeus had said those things of his own accord without anyone forcing him. Now Christ, in his turn, comes and says, today my beloved salvation has come to this house. What does this mean? What salvation? What was lacking in this house that you came, O my light, and saved it? What was lacking? That is the question. Some people think they are happy, some think they are healthy, and will live long upon the earth. They think they can go on living and doing as they please, conducting business, studying, advancing in life, marrying, traveling, achieving, and enjoying themselves. They imagine it. The blessedness and salvation of this house lie in the fact that Zacchaeus humbled himself and succeeded in bringing me into his home. That is it. Salvation is wherever Christ is, and perdition wherever there is Satan, the world, the self, self-interest, the flesh, Today salvation has come to this house, he says. The man was saved. He may have had possessions, but he did not have Christ. A person does not truly own material goods. They are not his. He merely manages them. And there is the further evil that he may steal certain things and then claim to manage those as well. God did not entrust those things to him. He did not acquire them honestly, morally, by the sweat of his brow, but obtained them by other means. Christ did not appoint him as steward over such things. A person should be the steward of what is truly his, what comes from his honest labor. Such things are blessed by God. God will never permit those things to be lost. He will not permit them to be spent on doctors or to be unjustly lost elsewhere. For as the proverb says, goods wrongly gathered are stored up for evil ends. Salvation, then, is to have come to know Christ. And it is ruin if you have come to know everything else except Christ. Today the Lord said it plainly. Today salvation has come to this house. And he adds one more thing, and with it he closes, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. The Son of Man came, he says, to seek and to save that which was lost. He regarded this person called Zacchaeus as a lost sheep. There is a parable about this. The shepherd who lost one sheep left the 99 and ran through the ravines to find it. And when he found it, he placed it upon his shoulders and returned rejoicing, saying, I have found it. He left the 99 and came to find the one that was lost. The lost one is the human being. The 99 are the angels, archangels, cherubim, seraphim, thrones, dominions, powers, all those who dwell above. He left them all and came down here, to this earth, this valley of weeping, to find the lost sheep. Someone may ask, why does he not find me as well? Why does he find some people, but not everyone? Does Christ show partiality? No, you are mistaken. Christ shows no partiality. For a sheep that has strayed from its shepherd to be found, it is not enough for the shepherd to desire it. The sheep must also desire to return to the fold. You may go out and search through the ravines yet not find it. The sheep has gone off, eaten somewhere, lain down, and is simply sitting there. It does not care that the wolf may devour it outside the fold that very night. It gives no thought to that. But suppose the sheep begins to bleat, seeking its mother or the rest of the flock. I ask you, is it not easy for the shepherd to find it when the sheep is bleating and desires to return? Then it is easy. But if the sheep has grown stubborn, has eaten its fill, and sits in one place, the shepherd cannot find it, because the sheep itself does not desire to return. It imagines that it is blessed there and that all is well, even though the wolf may devour it outside the fold. But the other sheep, which bleats and seeks its mother, its companions, its brothers, and its whole family, will easily be found by the shepherd. This is what the tax collector, the chief tax collector Zacchaeus, did. He sought to see Christ. He made such a great effort and such a sacrifice. He utterly humiliated himself, though he was a prominent man of Jericho. That is what chief tax collector means. Who are the three men who hold a city in their hands? He did all this, he sought him, and because he sought, he was found by the Savior. The Savior went to his house. Surely he said a few words to him, and he wanted those words. He was waiting for them. He saw the revelation the Savior gave him, which in this sense brought him down from up there, and that is how this salvation came about. Beyond the grave there is no salvation. On this side of the grave there is salvation and preparation. Beyond the grave our state is fixed. Whatever state the lens of death finds a person in, that will be his state in eternity. Those who have repented and confessed, who are honorable, moral, and faithful, will be on the right. The immoral, dishonorable, indifferent, unrepentant, and unconfessed fornicators, adulterers, murderers, and so forth, will be on the left. The lens of death is a dreadful thing. A person must fear it and beseech God, because he does not know when it will come. In a fraction of a second he may depart. Which of us knows whether we will return home tonight? A car mounts the pavement and mows down 40 people in the street like leeks. Who told you that you would return home? Do you have a ticket guaranteeing your journey tonight? And in what state will this lens of death find you? This is the great question for every person. If a person kept in mind that at any moment he might depart from this world, he would always keep his life in order. Zacchaeus had leprosy in his soul. The others had it in their bodies, yet through their ingratitude they carried it into their souls, because they did not return even to say a single thank you to Christ. I mean the 10 lepers whom we spoke about the other day. All except one. Tradition says that, as a sign of gratitude, Zacchaeus spent every summer of his life carrying tins of water to the sycamore tree and watering it, because it had helped him to see Christ, and the heat there in Jericho is extraordinary, since the city lies about 300 meters below the level of the Mediterranean Sea. As a sign of gratitude, do you see those others were ungrateful, even though he had healed them? But this man was thankful, and he leaves us this as a lesson too. And I pass it on to you, I hand it down to you. And my prayer is that we will take to heart both the homily of the other day on the 10 lepers and today's homily on Zacchaeus, and that we will draw the good fruits from the one and from the other. Amen.